Domino, Domino, only spot a few blacks behind you. Domino, Domino, only spot a few blacks behind you.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, everyone. I am your host, Robert Stevens, and this is the Black Work Experience Podcast. As you may know, I started this podcast because I was tired of being the only black male or one of the few black people at my organization. This can be crazy. I was constantly called upon to speak for the black experience or expected to do the emotional labor after blatantly racist things occurred. This is heavy, and it left me feeling fragile, unappreciated, and in need of a change. I began to ask my friends if they ever experienced being the only one or one of the few people of color at their job and the impact it had upon them. We discussed what it felt like to experience microaggressions and not have a friend or ally to lean on. Balancing the thin line between needing your coins and not being tokenized is never easy. The Black Work Experience explores the intersection between race, class, and privilege in America and in the workforce. We tell the stories of those who paved and are currently paving the way. As people of color gain more institutional, political, and economic power, we often find ourselves surrounded by people who do not look like us, talk like us, or even think like us. This podcast discusses what it's like to walk in the shoes of those who feel alone. I fully recognize that not all black people think alike. The stories we share on this podcast may seem foreign to you and your experience. However, a lot of black people experience microaggressions daily, and we need an outlet. This is your outlet. I want you to know that you are not alone. This podcast is for all people, but we focus heavily on black people. I want you to know that you're not the only one experiencing microaggressions, otherness at work, and potential loneliness. If you identify with majority culture, listen to the podcast. Think about how you can help your black colleagues when your coworker talks over them or runs to the manager instead of having a difficult conversation or even calls them intimidating. Lean in, listen, and learn. That's what we're asking of you.
This is Remington Belford, and you're listening to the Black Work Experience Podcast.
And we're here. Oh, I'm so excited to have Remington Belford, who is the communications director for Representative Yvette Clark. I mean, I'm going to tell you all, I've seen this young man all over Capitol Hill. He is one of the most sharpest dressing guys I've ever seen. I'm telling you, every time I see him, he puts me to shame. So I'm happy to have him on our podcast. We're going to dive through a few things tonight. We're going to look at what happened with the insurrection on Capitol Hill, what it's like to be a communications director on Capitol Hill, and how do you navigate this place and this space and this current time. So I'm going to turn it over to Remington. Remington, tell us a little bit about yourself. Who is Remington Belford?
Well, Tara, I just want to tell you, thank you so much for having me. I'm completely honored to share space. You've cultivated such a dynamic, following and a dynamic dissemination of information. So I'm super excited to be a part of this. What I'll say is Remington Belford is just this like fun loving, gregarious, hardworking Southerner who's been blessed to work for some of the most dynamic members of Congress. And I am an HBCU grad, Texas Southern University, where there's excellence and achievement.
Shout out to TSU.
You know, the real TSU. Let's be very clear. but I've just had the opportunity to work with some of the, like I said, some of the most dynamic members of Congress that has led me to the space that I am now. Family-oriented, wholesome, Christian, trying to dot every I and cross every T I can.
I know that's real. I just want to just take a moment and shout out HBCUs because, you know, I'm a byproduct of Winston-Salem State University.
And, say black college is sweeter than knowledge.
Come on, that is true. that is the truth. But I mean, what we see here, we're at the beginning, and I just want to dispel a lot of these rumors because a lot of times people say, oh, you know, I don't want to go to an HBCU because, you know, I want to be around what the world is like. You know, I need to be in more diverse, or I want to have access to more places or more opportunities. I want to let everyone know you're talking to Remington Belfort right now, communications director on Capitol Hill, who's a Black man and a byproduct of TSU, the real TSU. Let me make sure I put that in there for him. But like, you know, I attended an HBCU. I've worked on Capitol Hill, worked on President Obama's campaign, Congressman John Lewis, just done a lot of things. So I just want to make sure I let you all know, going to an HBCU does not limit your opportunities. I just want to make sure I always, always, always say that.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to reiterate that. I think it will amplify your opportunities, nurture your crafts in unique ways that other institutions may not be able to. And I think that oftentimes black colleges, or historically black colleges rather, have been siloed into some sort of like constructive monolith. And I think that couldn't be the furthest from the truth. I think that we are individualized microcosms that truly prepare black students and other students too. Let's be very clear, because people are flocking to HBCUs because they understand the type of cultivated knowledge that's going on and the nurturing that's going on in those spaces. So I'm a huge proponent, second generation graduate, a Texas Southern, and like I said, Black of the college, the sweet of the knowledge.
So. Black of the college, the sweet of the knowledge. That is a fact. So Raymond, take us on a journey, right? Take us on a journey through your professional career. What do you do? And like, how did you get there?
Well, I have a non-traditional venue. But we'll start, because I'll ramble. You know, I'll get nervous and I'll start rambling, but we'll start where I think the most pivotal moment in my career was I got accepted to the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation internship.
Okay.
It's this amazing institution that truly provides a platform and an opportunity for the best and the brightest young aspiring politicals to come to Capitol Hill and to work on Capitol Hill and to be able to afford to work on Capitol Hill, right? There is this huge income disparity and inequity that's present on Capitol Hill because you can't afford to live in DC. Right. You know, the first thing I told my parents when I got excited about getting accepted, I was like, oh, I'm going to D.C. My dad was like, well, how are you going to pay for it? You know, the first question, like first thing I needed to answer for him. And so I'm so grateful to the team and the members who work diligently to cultivate these resources that support Black people being funneled into Capitol Hill. So I got the opportunity to, you know, be a part of that intern cohort. And I will say that my cohort has like dynamic individuals who have, you know, gone on to work in the private sector, public sector, Capitol Hill, as well as now with the new administration, there are some amazing agency appointees that come out of my cohort. So I'm super excited about that. So I was working for Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee as an intern, and then I was offered the opportunity to join her staff. One of the things that I attribute to my continued success is the mentorship that I was afforded during my time as an intern. I came into contact with some dynamic people who truly told me, don't silo yourself, right? If you find something interesting, like follow that, right? Like figure that out to be what it is. And so I had an inclination for legislation. However, I found my niche in communications. And so what communications, in my opinion, and what I do is construct the narratives to work as a medium between the member, the legislative team, and then leadership and committees to craft the narratives that are specific to the, the 9th Congressional ninth Congressional District, or the constituency, if you will. Because oftentimes, one of the things that is most difficult about politics is that it's confusing. Mm. Right? Like so many people don't say that they don't enjoy politics because, to be quite frank, they don't understand it. Mm-hmm. That's a disservice that disproportionately impacts communities of color, right? And so one of the things that I'm, you know, blessed to have worked with two Black women in Congress at the height of their careers who are dedicated to ensuring that their constituents understand what they're doing on Capitol Hill. And so that's my main job.
Raymond, I want to ask this question because I'm hearing something, and I'm hearing you say you didn't come in initially wanting to be or focusing on comms or communication. You just liked it and like you found your niche. So you were not like, oh, I'm gonna work in communications.
No, yo, I was going to come out here and be a health policy, like, you know, guru, policy wonk, right? Like I was gonna write legislation that was gonna make all prescription drugs affordable.
Come on.
First hearing I went to was Jason Chaffetz and the honorable late great Elijah Cummings talking about prescription drug pricing and like holding these pharmaceutical companies accountable, right? Mm-hmm. I was passionate about that because my undergraduate studies are in biology and chemistry. And so I was passionate about that. But I was fortunate to come up under Mike McQuarrie, who, if anybody knows from Capitol Hill, they know Mike, Mayor Mike, who's the man around Capitol Hill, who knows everybody. He knows something about something. And if he doesn't, he knows someone who can make sure that you're informed.
For sure.
And I just took a liking to just the way that he moved. There's no other like more eloquent way to put it. Like Mike just was well-liked and delivered excellent, immaculate work. Right. And I just admired who he was as a black man, to see another black man working on Capitol Hill in a senior role. I just took to him. I had so many other like phenomenal communications directors who truly just, help shape my aspiration to be in communications. But Mike was truly pivotal because I was working in the same office as him. Right.
You're right. Right.
That's when I learned that, you know, Ledge is great. It gets the accolades and the acumen, but Ledge can go nowhere without communications. Communication serves as the conduit to the connection to the constituents.
That makes a lot of sense. And you talked about Mike, and if you had the opportunity to be on Capitol Hill, you definitely know him. And I want to talk to you about this because, you know, Mike is a black man. You are an African American man. It's not a lot of us on Capitol Hill. You know what I mean? Like it's really not. So my next question is like, how do you feel like your racial identity has really impacted your professional career? Do you think that you've been able to navigate it? I know you came onto the Hill through the CBC, Congressional Black Caucus Foundation internship. But other than that, how has your racial identity impacted your career?
I'll say that on Capitol Hill, it has instilled, because Terrell, you know what's up, right? Like,
I'm sure.
You're a black man on Capitol Hill. Every black person that is on Capitol Hill is excellent. We deliver immaculate work, and it's a storied history, an illustrious, in the HBCU, you know, vocabulary, an illustrious lineage of phenomenal black people that paved the way, and they're not afraid to look back and bring you with them. They're not going to mince words with you and tell you that, you know, salt is sugar, essentially, right? They're going to tell you exactly what it is and tell you exactly what you need to do to get there. Mm-hmm. And it's your choice and your decision to rise and or fall, right? And that's one thing that I think has been really cultivated in me is this insistence on excellence, because my predecessors are excellent. I mean, from people like Troy Clare to I don't want to like miss anybody, but like Twan Samuel, right? Mm-hmm. Amina Ross, these amazing human beings who took time to like nurture me and tell me these like important things were important, like were instrumental to me. But I will say, outside of Capitol Hill, trying to navigate, because there was a time where I took off a year to get my master's and thought I didn't want to go back. And I just kind of, you know, was wayward. And I noticed that despite this cultivated prowess that I got, that you can get nowhere else on Capitol Hill, that, you know, race still does play a role.
For sure.
And I think even here on Capitol Hill, even though the talent is undeniable, the opportunities are far too fleeting. That we're just not given the opportunities that we're prepared for.
For sure.
I'm honored to know Kimba and the House Diversity Initiative and the Senate Diversity Initiatives that are cultivating and carving out these spaces and holding people accountable for their lack of diversity on Capitol Hill. Because if given the opportunity, Black people will rise, specifically the Black people on Capitol Hill. Because I don't know a one person on Capitol Hill that is of the African-American persuasion that's not excellent.
Come on. Now that's a word. And I'll say this. It's something special. It's really something special about being there. it's like a fraternity, honestly, a sorority of individuals, because we're outnumbered. So outnumbered. And I just remember the first time being there, walking those hallowed halls. As someone, I was a political science major, so I've always been involved and excited about politics. But I also remember just walking the halls, seeing very few people who looked like me. But when I did see someone Black, no matter what, we gave each other the nod, the acknowledgement, the look, to let them know that, hey, like, I see you. Even though a lot of people may not see you, like, I see you. And I think about that. I think about that. There are four. Yeah, my recollection is correct, I think there are four African American chief of staffs in the Senate, right? And like, you have 100 members in the Senate. Like, the numbers are terrible. But it makes me think about like the origins, right? So we know that the Capitol was built by slaves. The White House is built by slaves. Yeah. And now you inhabit a space there as the communications director. Like, how do you grapple with the responsibility that comes with that?
Well, the first thing is I never lose sight of this prestigious opportunity. Let's be very clear. It's not lost on me that thousands of people wanted this job. Thousands were more qualified, in my opinion, for this job. And so every day I carry that with me. My chief of staff, Charlotte Stansberry, is probably one of the best human beings I've ever had the distinct pleasure of sharing space with. Right?
Shout out to Charlotte. You know I love her. Shout out to
everything. Like, when she hear this, if you hear this, Charlotte, like, let me just give you your flowers now, because you're everything.
For sure.
She saw something in me and took a chance on me. And I'm so grateful, because working under her tutelage, you just really see how excellent Black women are. Right? Mm-hmm. You really just see, like, the prowess, the acumen, the ability that's cultivated, that they're so willing to share.
Shout out to Black women, Remington. Black women.
Let's be very clear. Look, hashtag trust Black women. Hashtag support Black women. Hashtag it's Black women for me. Period.
Yes. No, that is real, because, you know, so many people apply for those jobs, and you mentioned it. So many people apply. So many people have friends, parents who are friends with the members, right? Yeah. And we think about these back doors that a lot of people get that we don't have access to. And so when we think about this podcast, you know, the Black Work Experience, we talk about those things. We grapple with the fact that we don't have the same access that a lot of other people have. And sometimes we have to like work so much harder to get ahead. We deal with the things like microaggressions. We deal with racism on an everyday basis, and we still have to show up. Yeah. And speaking about racism and microaggressions, you know, I want to dive into a very sensitive subject, you know, and I want to dive into it head first, knowing that you know, you're a Black man, you're working on Capitol Hill. And you're there after the January 6th insurrection. And in Remington, if I'm correct, you were actually there doing the insurrection. Am I correct?
Yeah, I was there.
Talk to me. Like, what was your experience like? Let's walk me through that day. What happened for you, and how did it transpire?
Well, so check this out, right? Like, you know, like, Tori, you know what's up. Like, you know that when there's a display, or there's a, you know, there's a protest, right? So you think that people are gonna be like, you know, shouting, touting, and doing all of their traditionally, you know, norms, right? Traditionally accepted norms. But like that day, like, I remember driving up. You know, I'm obnoxious when I'm, you know, around any type of like, you know, racism. So I'm like blasting, I'm Black and I'm proud, you know, as I'm driving up. And, you know, I meet with my boss. She goes in to vote for the procedural vote ahead of, you know, certifying the Electoral College vote. And you see this mass of people that are already past like one of the checkpoints. Right. And this is earlier in the morning. Right. And you're just like, yo, like, this is a little concerning, like, because normally this place is like, you can see people walking by, but you don't see people, you know, on the steps.
Right.
on the second level of the steps. Like, you know what's up? It's like the first level. Yeah. And that second level, you don't get past that first level unless you're a member. You know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
They got the long guns that, you know, crowd control is usually in place, heavy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so they were close to that, you know, that second, you know, level. And I was like, oh, this is a little concerning. They were loud. They were donning all these Trump flags and all this stuff. And it was just like, I'm not really feeling this. Talk to my boss. She's like, yeah, you know what? It'd be safer for me to go back to the office anyway, just to ensure that, like, you know, I'm not, you know, putting myself at risk, you know, because she has octogenarian parents you know, that she very closely is, you know, in community with. And so she's like, let me just, you know, head back to the office. So we heading back to the office, get to the office. Well, right before we got to the office, there is a Capitol Hill police officer's radio that, like, is like, yo, all Capitol police officers report to your post. And it's very solemn. Like, it was very, like, yo, like, something going down.
Right, right.
And it was just... that moment was like, yeah, this is, you know, scary. But then you still thinking, like, this Capitol Hill.
This is the Capitol, right?
You know, this is the most fortified and protected place in the country, if not the world, right? So that's the first thing I'm thinking. So I'm like, yeah, we all right, but let's get to the office just in case. You know what I mean?
For sure.
So me and Carson get to the office, you know, we close the door and turn on CNN. And I kid you not, seeing these people banging on the windows, like taking these spears, because they're no longer flagpoles, because that's been the narrative that's been purported, you know, that they just had flagpoles and they were unarmed. These were spears that they used to break this bulletproof glass to breach the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
So we're watching this as they are breaching the Capitol, laying siege to the seat of our democracy.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And I'm going to tell you when it got real. When I saw them in Statuary Hall, and I saw them going down the hallways that lead to, you know, Whip Clyburn's office.
Mm-hmm. How do they even know where Whip Clyburn's office is?
How do you know where that's at? I still get lost. I still need an escort. You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Like,
I still
exactly.
don't know exactly how to get there.
Exactly.
I mean, and they're in Speaker Pelosi's office. And I got friends that work in both of those offices,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And I know if I'm sitting here terrified from Rayburn, I couldn't imagine the fear that they were experiencing.
Exactly.
So watching it, and next thing you know, they're at the speaker's lobby.
Mm.
Like, and I know that place all too familiar because when I was an intern, that's where Congresswoman Jack Lee used to make all the interns wait, you know, mm-hmm. it's kind of a passage,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to see these people just there without a badge, they just were there. You know what I mean? Like they didn't have any clearance. Like, the difficulty it takes to get from Rayburn to the speaker's lobby is just like, it's mind blowing that these people were able to do that. So we're watching it, and then you see them in on the Senate floor, like you see them like going through senators' personal paperwork. You're like, that blew my mind. Like these are senators. Mm-hmm. Not just the House members, because let's be very clear. Both of the chambers were, you know, attacked. But the way that they went about, like, berating the Capitol and infringing on the sanctity of the Senate was just beyond me. I'm so mm-hmm. grateful that the Capitol Police held it down on the House side, because, you know, House side's the best side. You know, sorry to say it, but it is what it is. Capitol Police, they held it down. But had those people got into the House floor, they were members. They were staffers. My homegirl Sarah was there with her boss on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, praying. Congresswoman Lisa Blount Rochester was calling him. You hear me? Praying, calling him. And I think that's directly attributable to the safety that was maintained.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But these members who fight diligently for the fortification and the advancing of our democracy were just encapsulated in a makeshift prison in the space that they were creating laws to certify the election that the American people had voiced their contempt for Donald Trump, right? And outside of the halls, you see these sycophantic supremacists trying to lay siege, trying to do harm, trying to, in my opinion, murder whoever they can come in contact with. Mm-hmm. The problem is out, right? I know what it's like to see a mob of racist white people. I'm going to be completely honest with you, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I've never seen a display of hyper aggression, hatred, and just crazed people in that large of a quantity focused on that singular of a target.
Yeah.
It's still concerning. I'm gonna tell you, I talk to my therapist regularly about it, but it just, that was scary. Mm. That was scary, especially for Black staffers, particularly for Black staffers, because they were looking for elected officials. There were custodians that were hiding in the closets, right? Mm-hmm. We can't blend in like some of the other, you know, people on Capitol Hill can, right? And 9 times out of 10, if you see melanin, you see Democrat. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, and so that was concerning. And then we in our office, and I'm like, well, we're down the hall from Auntie Maxine. You know what I mean? Like we around the corner, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene ain't that far from, you know what I mean? Like they could come if she's, it was a whole type of like slew of thoughts that came in your mind that it's blood curdling, right? Like it just was. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was a day I'll never forget. I will never forget that. I will never ever forget that day. It will live in infamy in my mind. And I'm be honest with you, I'm gonna tell the story as many times as I can because it's too susceptible to revision. It's too susceptible to dilution. It's too susceptible to being rewritten. Even now, hearing senators who were feared for their lives saying that these people weren't armed, saying that these were just a jolly gaggle of intense, you know, people on the Capitol. That wasn't the case. Couldn't have been further from the truth.
I think for me, as someone who's walked those halls and both as a staffer and even as a lobbyist, right? Like I still hold those places in such high regard. You know, like I remember the first time I walked through Statuary Hall. Right. I remember I've only been on the floor of the House one time. You know, a bill that I wrote for the congressman was being heard and it passed. And he took me to the floor to sit behind him and like experience that. And like I likened it to like someone, you know, as a young kid talking about my mom. You know, when you're a little kid and someone say so much of those fighting words, you know, like the level of disrespect. And I sat, I had just started a new job the day before. And, you know, I'm running this policy division in D.C. And I'm like, this is not happening. You know what I mean? And like, we're frantically on calls. Like we shut down the office for the day because people, like we had friends, you know, I have several friends, numerous friends who work on the Capitol, in the Capitol complex. And I was just like, what is going on? And so I think personally, like, I was hurt. People like, you know, it moved me to tears, honestly, because, and I still get emotional about it because like people were willing to kill individuals over Donald Trump and this like false notion that he won the election. But I think most importantly, like I really believe in democracy. You know, like we don't do this work, right? Not truly believe, like I really believe in like the peaceful transition of power. I believe that like we put everything on the line for that first Tuesday in November. You know what I mean? And for that to be potentially washed away was difficult to watch.
You know, I think, Tori, like you said, my patriotism has been like heightened since that day. You know what I mean? Like And a lot of my friends are becoming cynical about, like, you know, well, you know, this is America. This is what normally happens. They take what they, you know, want. And it's, you know, but for me, it just, it doesn't hit, it hits different now. You know what I mean? Like, it just, to be there and to know that, like, I'm standing alongside these elected officials who are dedicated to the preservation and the advancement of our democracy truly has heightened a sense of pride for me. Right. I am very proud to be an American. I'm very proud to be a Black American who works on Capitol Hill. I'm very proud that those elected officials still took the time, had the fortitude at 9:30 at night to say, even despite this domestic terrorist attack, we're going to continue to certify these elections because this is what the American people wanted. Right. And even then, we didn't get home till 2:30, 3:00 in the morning. Right. Mm-hmm. Some people on the other side of the aisle still had the audacity, the gall to contest some of the elections, some of the votes rather. But, I truly can say that, like, everybody who was on the Hill that day, proximal to the Hill and truly tapped into that, the Hill on that day, has a new renewed or advanced pride and patriotism that to me truly separates us from those sycophantic supremacists because we live in honesty, truth, right? We live in a world where what is truly, right? And what isn't is not, right?
For sure.
And I think that those people were highly susceptible to believing some garbage from this, you know. I don't want to demean this man because he's been demeaned enough. Like, he exists. I mean, that's it for me. But they were susceptible.
Yeah. Let me. What are the last thing, like? I think about the police officers, individuals who lost their life. I know a lot of friends. I have a good friend who's a member of the Capitol Police. And we were texting, and there are some lingering, some residual effects of what happened on January 6th, you know. Today's March 7th, so it's been, you know, a little over one day over 2 months. We just hit a two-month mark. But people are still feeling the effects of what happened January 6th. Are there any, like, lingering things? You know, I know you say you talked to your therapist about it. Are there, like, lingering issues? Are you concerned more now about your safety? Are you in this heightened sense of concern?
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to be completely transparent with you in this space. Where I once would, you know, adorn my badge so that everybody could see that I'm a staffer. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have the intern badge. I have a staff badge, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Where I once would do that, I now hide it behind my coat or my jacket. Because you never know when this type of behavior could be repeated. I'm very skeptical of anyone who occupies, you know, the other side of the aisle. I'm notoriously known for, I'll speak to anybody. I was raised to see the good in everyone. My faith teaches me to love that neighbor like I love myself, but I'm gonna be completely 100 with you. I just don't see how those people on the other side of the aisle still occupy that mindset. And who could have been privy to involvement at all. I just don't see how they live with themselves. Because I personally am no longer in communication with a couple of Republican people and staffers that, like, are in these offices that, you know, these members are touting and advancing this big lie. Because I don't trust you. Like, you, in my mind, you might as well just have opened the door for them. Like, you advanced it, instigated it, right? So you may have opened the door. So I don't know what that means if we don't have the security of the Capitol. If we're going to chill it, you know, when things are open up, I can't trust you because I don't know if I'm walking into some sort of ambush. And that type of heightened sensitivity I didn't own, right? Like, I've been all over with a lot of different people, but I'll tell you that, like, I'm not feeling, you know, a lot of my Republican colleagues, and I would venture to even call them friends previously. I'm not with it because the anger, the hatred, the division that these people were trying to, you know, that these people were existing in, it, you know, that don't just go away. You don't just blink and it's gone. You know what I mean? they don't just disappear. These people still own these mindsets. They're still here. They're just quiet about it because it's now being frowned upon.
I think that's a very good point. It also makes me want to ask you about the culture on the Hill now, you know, as a result of that, because I've read, you know, I actually saw where, you know, some members were, you know, introducing votes that they normally would not vote. You know what I mean? They were calling for full votes on the naming of a post office. You know, that's something that usually passes, you know, it just passes with consent, voice vote. You know what I mean? But now people are doing, you know, no, I need to. There's animosity there. Members feel because their lives were literally in jeopardy. Right? Like people were afraid that they were going to die. I've heard members who sent text messages to their family members saying, "Hey, I love you. If something happens to me, I want you to know I love you." So like, and members are refusing. Some members I've heard are refusing to work with some of these individuals who put this thought forward that, oh, the election was stolen. So what is the culture like now? Is it tense still?
It's definitely tense. I mean, it was already, you know, hyper-partisan prior to that, very clear. And it's not on behalf of the Democrats because in our defense, we have extended the elected officials have extended every olive branch available to the point where it's a bit annoying, right? But it's the truth. They have extended every opportunity to work in a bipartisan fashion and in a way to ensure that like Republicans are included despite the Democratic majority. But I will say that a lot of members are now y'all was trying to kill me, essentially. They may not say that because they're, you know, diplomatic in their spaces, but you see it how they move.
You see it.
They ain't no like, you know, you see them in the hallways passing and normally they just like say hello and it's just like a, you know, warm, just gentle exchange. No, it's stoic silence. Mm. I mean, like, you know, like unless they were old friends before them, I'm just not seeing that type of camaraderie. And the same with the staff, right? Like we're skeletal crew. So like, you know, it's not everybody's on Capitol Hill due to the pandemic, but you know, who's on the Hill? Because you see them regularly because you do the same thing over and over again. You go down one hallway, same hallway, you know what I mean? Like, you know who works for whom because they're on the same hallway as you. And, you know, people that I would normally be like, "Hey, good morning, what's up, how are you? You know, you doing all right?" Now it's like, I'm not part of my lips to speak to you because I feel like you are part of that. And the funny thing is, even if they weren't a part of it, they're still privy to it because they're aligning themselves with members and offices that have advanced this big lie.
They're complicit. They're complicit.
Yeah, complicit. Yes.
And they're complicit. I want to talk a little bit about microaggressions because, in my opinion, that may have been one of the biggest microaggressions against Black people. We think about how over the summer, when protests were taking place on the Capitol and in D.C., National Guard, everyone was there. Right, the Capitol was shut down, but we saw how, you know, a big group of predominantly white individuals came, and it looked very different. You know, they were literally able to walk up the front door. There's video of Capitol Police officers, and you know, they're on investigation as we speak, like taking pictures with these individuals. I've also been told that, you know, some of them actually pointed and gave them directions to get to places, right? This makes me think about like microaggressions because in my opinion, like once again, this is just a huge microaggression. And we know microaggressions are real, but they're not always, you know, immediately apparent to everyone else. I want to know, like, can you share one of your most memorable or painful microaggressions that you've experienced professionally?
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to preface this by saying, I have experienced so many positive interactions with Capitol Police officers, from them knowing I'm a little scary to walking me to my car, you know what I mean? Like chatting it up in the morning. So I'm going to preface that because there are some dynamic human beings who serve and protect the Capitol. And I'm honored to work alongside them. But I did have an experience where I was young and I was trying to escort this group of, you know, constituents from Texas that had come up, and we had to go, instead of going the traditional way the staff goes, you had to go around the Cannon Tunnels and like goes a long way. And they just made it so difficult. And like one of the police officers was just, in my opinion, on a, like, it just had some chip on his shoulder. He was just rude. He was obnoxious. And I was just, you know, like, yo, like, these are like elderly people just trying to view the Capitol. They're, you know, let them through. And he was just obnoxious. And it was just to the point where, you know, I had to go get my boss to, you know, kind of dismantle or defuse the situation because of the just insensitive and insufferable behavior I was experiencing. And, you know, it just felt like because I was this young Black staffer that, you know, this white police officer was giving me difficulties. And I'm also very sensitive to police as a whole because I'm from the South again, right? Police serve and protect in the South, but they also are, you know, some of the worst people and the most dangerous people, right? So you're taught from a young age to be cautious, right? To be respectful, not to say anything unnecessary to them, right? And so that type of mindset, that teaching has followed me here, right? So I, you know, unless it's, you know, someone that looks like me or, you know, someone who's gone out their way to be welcoming, I, you know, stay kind of, you know.
Keep your distance.
Distance, right, exactly. But I'll say that that was one of the days where, I mean, not even my badge could like diffuse the situation. Do a complete and utter just, you know what I'm gonna say, but I'm not gonna, you know,
yeah,
that. But he was terrible. He was terrible. And there's stories that are similar that have happened, and more aggressive stories with Capitol Police officers. But I will end by saying there are also, in contrast, so many beautiful stories of fortitude, support, camaraderie that Capitol Police officers, you know, have done and have, you know, experienced with, you know, staffers. But there are also some ugly truths about the fact that there are some true microaggressions and they're being investigated, because I'm gonna tell you, I would venture to say, like, of those people who are being, you know, investigated, I don't know his name, but if I saw his face again, I wouldn't be surprised if he was one of those people who, you know, was investigated, because you have no reason to be that ugly. You don't have no reason to be that ugly unless you're full of hate. Yeah. And I hate that for you.
I tell you what, I share that. I can't say that I've necessarily had bad experiences with the Capitol Police, with Capitol Police officers. I think that they've always been very quick to like check for a badge. You know what I mean? Like, you have your badge. You know, and I think that that was one of the reasons why I was also very surprised what happened January 6th, because I know how hard it was for me to traverse the Capitol as a staffer.
Yeah.
You know, like you, like, there was, oh no, you can't come in here. You got to go around. Oh, here's my badge. You know, you still can't go around. That was one of the ways that it was very difficult for me to traverse that. So I want to talk to you about something that I think is super duper important, and that is how many times you've been the only person of color in an office, and like, how did you handle that, right? So like, and I just want to make sure I have the arc of your career correct. So did you get the fellowship immediately after undergrad and you came onto the Hill? Is that how that worked for you?
No. So I graduated. I don't like to tell the story because I was old and I was outside of the age demographic, and a couple people, you know, advanced me over a little bit because I was 2 years instead of 1 year out of undergrad. So I don't like to tell that story, but I was working at a nonprofit that sat at the intersection between marginalized communities and pharmaceutical companies to support them with housing, medication assistance, HIV prevention and treatment, and just a myriad of other things, community-based or federally qualified healthcare center. And so I did that. And then I had encountered a lady who reminded me of my grandmother, who couldn't get her medication despite, you know, Obamacare and, you know, despite, you know, all of the provisions that had been made for her. She still wasn't able to because there are still difficulties and disparities in our healthcare system. And I was able to interact with my chief medical officer, who told me if I wanted to change healthcare policy, then I should get involved in politics. And so I took that literally, right? What I said earlier about the passion for healthcare policy.
Right.
I knew I was going to come in here and change things. So I then was an intern with Congresswoman Jackson Lee, Texas 18th Congressional District, then was offered a role let me make sure I get this title right, because I fought for it. It was legislative aide and operations manager. And then I was promoted to press secretary. And then I negotiated another title because I couldn't get a raise after a year for a digital director and legislative aide, legislative assistant. And so I did that, took off a year for my master's program and you know, had a couple like odd ends to make ends meet that I don't really just, reference because they're not aligned with my career trajectory. And then got back, came back, same office, left that office after another year, was afforded the opportunity to work with the Jackie Gordon for Congress campaign. Mm-hmm. Jackie Gordon, who ran for Pete King's seat, who was unfortunately unsuccessful, but she was one of the most amazing human beings. I use the word amazing a lot, I guess because I'm nervous, but I usually have a profuse vocabulary ready to throw in there. But Jackie was just a great human being.
Good.
She just she taught me so much in such a short time, and her team on the D-Trip and Emily's List and these amazing people. So I then we were unsuccessful, and then Charlene swooped in like she always does, this amazing human being, and said, for a comms director. And I was afforded the opportunity to join Congresswoman Yvette Clark's team. And, and the interesting thing is my second day was the insurrection.
Wow.
So I literally was brand new. So it was a, great time for me and the Congresswoman to bond because we couldn't go nowhere for more than 12 hours.
Exactly. So like in all these experiences, have you ever been the only person of color on staff or at your organization?
Well, the fortunate thing is that I've worked in, smaller, nothing too notable to where like, it was something I took concern with. It was just like, I got to do it. So let me just,
let me deal with it.
Yeah. But I've overwhelmingly, from going to an HBCU to even at my graduate program in GW, there were a myriad of Black women who were there. I was the only Black, Black man in my program, but some dynamic Black women that were there. And then working on Capitol Hill in a predominantly Black office, I've been fortunate to work with some excellent Black folks. So I can't say I've been the only Black person in a space where, an adult career, right? Like, that's not like, Sunglass Hut in college or something like that. But I've not had that pleasure, and I'm glad I haven't, to be quite honest with you.
Well, I'm going to tell you, as someone who has had very different experiences professionally, I've almost always been the only Black, definitely the only Black man. Almost always the only Black man. There may have been another fantastic, dynamic, amazing, as you like to say, Black woman there, but that like charting the path has been something that I've had to do a lot, and I found that to be, very different. Not different, but difficult. The burden of being Black, the burden of being excellent all the time, the burden of having to always think about how my actions reflect on people who look like you and I is a burden that I'm glad you have not had to navigate as much. And that's important, man. That's important. I want to ask you this, transition a little bit and think about like you and your career, this story career, because you're really, right around the apex, as a comms director, someone who sets, like you literally set the tone for how people digest what Congresswoman Clark is doing, right? Like you share that, you think about that all the time. So my question to you is, what do you wish you would have known now? What do you wish you would have known when you started your career that you know now?
Let me tell you something, man. I would have been a communications major, African-American studies minor. I would have enjoyed college. About chemistry space, you know, to impress my parents and to, you know, make sure everybody knew I was smart. It would have been a non-starter for me. And I would have went down a path of passion and truly cultivated this skill set a lot earlier. So I find myself being, you know, one of the older ones in my friend group. Now, granted, I'm still very young, but some of my friends are, you know, 2 and 3 years younger than me because, you know, they've seen, you know, the trajectory of their careers, you know, align earlier because, you know, they trusted their intuitions earlier than I did. And I also would have like paid more attention to like English and grammar and you know, I would have not given my AP English professor, you know, in high school, a hard time. I'd have paid attention to you know, things a lot quicker if I knew now. I also would have studied politics more. Would have definitely studied and saw the different intricacies that a lot of, as you know, as you were a poli-sci major, a lot of you all have an understanding that's intrinsic because you studied it for more than 4 years. And you know, there are still things that like are simple to, you know, other people that are, you know, perplexed to me. But I would have done a lot of things different, but you know, you don't exist in regret. Like you look forward, right? Like you focus on everything that you can do that you haven't done. And then you also impart that wisdom to everybody who is coming up under you so that they don't make the same mistakes. And that's a sense of pride that like overshines that regret is seeing these young, I call them babies, even though they're grown, because seeing these babies come up under me and ask me these questions. And I take such great pride in telling them like, yo, I would have done this way. Mm-hmm. You got this available to you. I would do it this way. Pay attention in this space, you know, do this, learn that, be that, go there. And living vicariously through them is truly one of the honors of my life.
What do you think are some of the best resources that that have helped you along the way?
Black people on Capitol Hill, to be very clear. Come on. But let's start with Congressional Black Associates.
CBA.
Intern, and they supported me. Jordan Lawrence, shout out to Jordan. Like, she was the then secretary, and she was like, I was like, I want to learn about this. And she's like, okay, well, here, come work with me. We'll learn this. And then she let me go and talk to these chief of staffs about, you know, things that were important to me. Mm-hmm. And these big, high-rolling chief of staffs took the time to chat it up with me. Shout out to Shashrina. Shashrina walked me from Rayburn to the Capitol, just chatting it up, right? Shout out to Michael Collins, like, just walked me from, like, you know, all that. It just was amazing.
Let me just shout out Michael Collins, too, because, you know, I've worked for Congressman Lewis, and Michael Collins to this day is still a recommendation for me, a recommender for me. So like whenever I apply to jobs, I put Michael Collins and he shows up for me. And I actually owe Michael Collins a drink. So shout out to Michael Collins because he holds me down as well.
Yeah, Mike was amazing. But that was the culture that's been created. You know what I mean? Like you work on Capitol Hill, we all have those people. You know, like you was in Congressman John Conyers' office, Ms. Jamila, she's amazing. You know what I mean? Like, shout out to Marcus, like from the entire team, like that space of like cultivated knowledge and prowess and freely sharing that information, right? Sure. CBA definitely put me in a place to know that and nurture that. So I stayed in CBA, became vice president under Lewis Myers. Shout out to President Lewis Myers.
Shout out to Lou, my man Lou. Shout out to Plaskett office. Shout out to Lou.
Yeah, man. Working with him, truly like, it was an honor, you know, him, Sam, Earl, Keenan, Jamie, Francesca. Shout out to Francesca, right?
Like, shout out to Francesca.
Let's be very clear. Like, I work with some of the most amazing people, but my job was truly just to like go out and bring every black person I could in the CBA, right? And that meant from intern to chief of staff. And I will say that I don't remember being turned away and negatively rebuffed when talking about CBA because everyone understood the importance of, you know, this fraternity, this sorority, this cultivated community of Black Hill staffers. Mm-hmm. Also, CBCF, to be very clear, like, despite just being an intern, they nurture you throughout that. They're mm-hmm. still available as resources if you need them, right? They still will sit down and talk to you. Miss Tasha Cole, like, mm-hmm. everybody in DC know that she's the, like, she is, like, the plug, right? I had an event, you know, I was going to have, like, and she was like, yo, you let me know whatever you need, I'm there. You know, like, those people, like, that's what made me want to be better.
Yes,
like,
yes.
That's what made me insist on this, like, excellence. That's what makes me insist on, like, my mantra of teamwork makes a dream work. Because all these people who came before me who were excellent, who didn't have to take the time to even share one word with me, opened their encyclopedias and said, what is it that you need? What is it that you require? How can I help? Right? And constantly followed up and followed through in that space. And so that's what's helped me, for sure.
So we just talked about, like, all the Black people who have helped you. And it's a two-part question that I want to ask. The first question is, you know, let's talk about, like, the Black Lives Matter movement. There's mm-hmm. a tremendous amount of Black people who helped you, CBC. You know, we named all these individuals. Like, has the Black Lives Matter movement made its way to Capitol Hill? And if so, what does it look like?
Let's be very clear. The Black Lives Matter movement is in response to the lack of respect placed on Black lives, to the murder of Black lives, to the I get emotional talking about that, because it's just peculiar that we're still at this moment explaining it, right? Like, the Black Lives Matter movement is literally a movement in response to preserve Black lives, preserves and protect Black lives, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And so, if to say that it's made its way to Capitol Hill, it's always been on Capitol Hill. Let's be very clear. It's being described now because, in, you know, different ways, people want to attribute negative depictions to it, right? Negative descriptions to it. But the truth is that the lives that are on Capitol Hill that are Black matter. Mm. The people who are working on behalf of the marginalized, disproportionately impacted communities that happen to be Black matter. And the policies that come out of the office, like your office with Congressman John Conyers introducing reparations in, what, 1979, you know?
Mm-hmm. Congressman Lewis, John Lewis.
I'm sorry, my bad. I got excited. With look.
You're right.
You know, those types of policies, those types of legislative measures.
For sure, for sure.
Prioritize the preservation of Black lives has been on Capitol Hill. I mean, since the Shirley Chisholm days, since the, you know, original CBC members, right? I mean, under the tutelage of Chairwoman Beatty, who is the chair of diversity and inclusion, like, I absolutely adore her. Let's be very clear. This woman is a champion for diversity at all levels. That's because Black lives matter, right? Previously, Chairwoman Karen Bass, right? Focusing on justice and policing, Black lives matter. So to say that, like, you know, it's made its way, it's never left. Let's be very clear. It's now been pronounced because it has been galvanized to combat the targeted murders of Black lives. But the truth is that this movement is truly multifaceted. This movement is not new and it's not going anywhere, right? It's been depicted as this negative, potentially, you know, incendiary, you know, group of people. But the truth is that the foundation, what Black Lives Matter means, is Black Lives Matter. Like, we matter, right? From the janitor to the member of Congress, we matter. And all of us were in fear for our lives on January 6th. All of our lives matter. You know what I mean? Like, so I don't know if that answered it the way that, you know, we had hoped it would, but for me, it that's exactly what it meant.
We talked about Black people and, like, Black allies who stood up for you. What about any white allies? Do you have any white allies, people who stood up and looked out for you?
Oh, for sure. Like, I'm gonna tell you, I work in communications now. My sixth grade English teacher, Miss Susan Brins like saw something in me, and I hated writing. She was just like, Remington, you're so great at this. And she kept up with me. She constantly kept up with me. And my eighth grade science teacher, she then was the person who put me in like advanced science because she saw something in me, right? And full circle moment, she came to lobby on behalf of, you know, her son's, I forgot which ailment it was. She was lobbying, and I ran into her. Mm-hmm. And I saw, like, you know, this woman who had truly like advanced, you know, my life because she had, you know, felt something to pour into me. And then I'm gonna be completely honest with you, my friends, I grew up in, you know, predominantly white spaces, but in college and post-college, I was in predominantly black spaces. So I made a concerted effort to have white friends. Mm-hmm. And I'm gonna tell you, some of my white friends truly have been backbones for me. I mean, when this was happening, they were some of the most involved and engaged. You know what I mean? Like, are you okay? Are you good? Are you hiding? Are you, you know? But yeah, definitely. Definitely. I've had a plethora of people of all colors truly stand up for me and stand in for me. And I'm truly grateful for that.
So if you could broadcast a message to white allies who want to step up during this time of like, this movement of Black Lives Matter movement during this time of like protecting the democracy from individuals who will seek to destroy it, what would you tell them to do? Like, what advice do you have for white people who want to be allies?
Oh, that's deep. Because let's be very clear, like, allyship is not a monolith.
Come on.
Like, let's be very clear. Like, you can't just check these boxes and you now become this ally. But I would tell them to listen. Right, out of the way, let your ego move back and truly listen to the concerns of the people who you hope to stand as an ally for, you know, and then figure out why you truly standing as an ally, because if you don't stand on something, you'll fall for anything.
Come on.
I think that's difficult for, you know, saviors, quote unquote, to figure out is like truly why are they doing it. Finally, it's just like, if you're going to do it, commit to it. Be the best at it, right? Truly utilize your privilege to facilitate change, right? And understand that that may put you at a disproportionately, you know, impacted negative space, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You may be scrutinized. You may, you know, lose that position of privilege that you've grown so accustomed and comfortable to, right? Like, that may be the case. So be completely honest with yourself and say, is that something you can handle? But the main thing is just like, finish it. If you start it, finish it and be the best at what you can do, right? And listen and know why you're doing it.
That's real. So what parting words would you leave for Black people who come behind you? Let's say the individuals like this podcast is in 17 countries right now. We're blessed. It's been translated into so many different languages. People are listening to me. So like, they're listening to you. What would you say to Black people, maybe that Black young professional who wants to be a communications director, wants to get on Capitol Hill? What would you say to them?
I would say, be kind, be authentic, work hard, right? And know that the combination of those three can truly get you places. You know, stay prayed up if you are a Christian or whatever your choice of religion is, or if you choose not to be religious, just be diligent in knowing that there's a greater, higher power that will intercede on your behalf, right? And I know that for certain, because there's no other explanation of the blessings that have been bestowed on me, because favor ain't fair. Be very honest with you. And then also remember that, like, when you get, Toni Morrison said, when you get these jobs that you've been so brilliantly trained for, make sure you teach someone, make sure you bring somebody with you, right? It's nothing if you close the door behind you when you fought so hard to get in the room, right? It's nothing if you got a seat at the table, but you're the last person to sit at that table, right? Mm-hmm. You bring somebody with you. Teamwork makes the dream work. And that's exactly what I've learned on Capitol Hill. That's the most overwhelming principle that I believe that has been bestowed on me, is that when you get somewhere, you bring someone. When you learn something, you teach someone, right? And teamwork truly does make the dream work.
That is real. And that makes me, it really, really, really makes me think about something. I had the opportunity to live in Dallas for a few years. And when I lived
hold that against you. I'm not going to hold it.
Don't hold it.
Houston. You know,
I know you're from Houston. And when I was in Dallas, I was really, really involved with the National Urban League, the YP, Young Professionals. And I never forget going to a meeting and Dr. Haynes, his name is Bishop Dr. Frederick Douglass Haynes, the third to be exact, but he was the pastor at Friendship West Baptist mm-hmm. Church. And he came and he spoke to us and he said this, and it always resonated with me. He said, "You all are smart. You all are doing really good. You're going to be in some amazing positions if you're not already in those positions now." He said, "When that door opens, I want you to be the wedge." He said, "Don't allow that door to close without pulling more people who look just like you through it." And so that has always resonated with me. And I think that what you said, teamwork makes the dream work, coupled with being that wedge, is going to help us continue to get free. Remington, where can our listeners connect with you online? Because you dropped some gems, and I know these people are going to want to connect with you. So where can they connect with you online?
Well, definitely follow me on Twitter or Instagram. I don't post as much because, you know, when you post it for someone else, the timeline look real exhausting. But Remington with two M's, F as in Frank, B as in boy on Facebook, on Instagram and Twitter. That's where you can find me.
Thank you so much, Remington. I want to thank you for joining the Black Work Experience podcast. I want to thank you for diving deep, sharing your experiences as a Black staffer on Capitol Hill. I want to thank you for just everything you've given us, because you've dropped some real gems, and I look forward to working with you in the future. I'll be back in D.C. I see you. I'll be around the complex. Coffee, drinks on me next time.
Well, Tori, I just want to say quickly that this podcast is truly a phenomenal, stellar example of fortitude and work ethic and Black excellence. And I'm truly honored to be a part of this. Thank you so much. And next time, coffee's actually on me, because I found this little coffee spot, you know, a little duck off, you know. So, but it, truly, truly honored. Thank you for thinking of me for this opportunity. It truly is not lost on me, the grandeur that this platform has advanced. So I'm truly honored. Truly honored.
Thank you. Have a good one. Thank you, Remington.
All right. Take it easy.
Thanks for listening to the Black Work Experience podcast. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review us. If you would like to hear more, follow us on IG at BWEP. We're also on Twitter at BWE Podcast. Black Work Experience is hosted and produced by me, Robert Stevens. Our show is mixed by strategic communication specialist Sarah Daggett. Find out more about her amazing work at DaggettConsultingLLC.com. That's Daggett, DAGGETT, ConsultingLLC.com. Our theme music was composed by Cameron Wright. If you would like to contribute to Mail Time, please submit your mail times on our IG at BWE Pod. You can also DM us on Twitter at BWE Podcast or via email at blackworkexperiencepod@gmail.com.
Domino, domino, on the spot a few blacks are hanging out. Domino, domino, on the spot a few blacks are hanging out.
Hello, everyone.